Hello, South by Southwest and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and halfway across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is just a terrific film critic and a hella busy one, contributing to the New York Times, IndieWire, Screen Daily, and of course, RogerEbert.com, where he is associate editor. He's a member of the African American Film Critics Association, the Chicago Film Critics Association, and the Critics' Choice Association, and he is joining me here in Austin, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the eve of South by Southwest, the man, the myth, Mr. Robert Daniels. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Jason. Mike, thank you for having me. Yeah, I mean, it's hilarious because we were just talking pre-show about, like, oh, this is, like, our break away from, like, our dreary cities, and it's actually pretty dreary here.
yeah, it's not as sun-baked as usual, but I've looked ahead, and we've got a nice week ahead of us, so it is just the way it falls on the calendar is that by early March, both a New York resident and a Chicago resident are ready for a little bit of sunshine and a little bit of a high temperature. So this will air a couple of weeks after South by Southwest because we're kind of stacking shows up, but we're recording it on the day before opening and the Thursday before Oscar night. So not to put you on the spot, but any predictions you'd like to make now, and then we'll see if you're right when it airs.
Yeah, sure. As long as you promise to delete and we can re-record.
Oh, of course. Obviously. That's the ethical way to do it.
But yeah, I think, let's see, Best Picture is going to be Oppenheimer. Best Director is going to be Nolan. Mm-hmm. Best Actor, you know, I'm kind of like wary of picking the trifecta, you know, mm-hmm. but like... Mm-hmm. Even though I still kind of feel like Paul Giamatti's in it. You know, faded, you know, but like, you know, it might be his last chance. Yeah. You know, hopefully not. But I kept thinking for Killian, this was like his like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy nomination, mm-hmm. where it's like mm-hmm. the Gary Oldman, like you get one and then you know, the next one we give it to you. But I guess I'm gonna go Killian and Best Actor, Best Actress, Lily Gladstone. The incomparable Lily Gladstone, and then the two races that are done, which is
right.
supporting actors, Robert Downey Jr. and Devon Joy Randolph.
No upsets coming there. All right. Well, we'll go back to these, and I'm sure they'll all be correct. We were talking about this a little bit before show, actually, but how many times have you been to South by Southwest now?
This is my third time, yeah. So the first time I came was in 2019. You know, of course, Austin was a lot different. Mm-hmm, feels mm-hmm. like every single gap I take, I'm like, oh, this is a totally different city from the last time I was here. Yep. And then the second time was in 2022. So it was like first time back from pandemic, and then this is the third time.
Yeah. So as a Chicagoan, what do you appreciate about Austin?
Food.
Yeah. Big old same. Food. You have the same kind of trouble getting good barbecue in Chicago as I do.
You know, there are a couple of spots in Chicago. Yeah. That I'm fucking suddenly blanking on. On the north and northwest side, there are a couple of spots that are pretty good that I will probably remember later tonight. I'd be like, oh yeah, I should have told Jason, Jason and Mike in case they visit Chicago.
Never know.
Anytime soon. But no, I mean, it's really the plethora of options here.
Yes.
In Austin, that's amazing. And of course, you know, not just, you know, the barbecue, it's, you know, Tex-Mex, some of the best breakfasts I've ever had have been here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The fusion food that's here. It's just chili, which is probably what I'm going to get to eat when we're done recording.
Very good.
You know, it just, the list just goes on.
Yeah, no, I just came here from Gus's Famous Fried Chicken. So, it hit the spot. All right. Well, then, I don't want to keep you too long from your chili. So let's get down to business. What year did you choose to walk through with us today and why?
I chose 1965, and
which is intriguing. This is not a lionized era per se.
No, it's not. I mean, it's actually kind of like I didn't even like when you'd ask the question. I was like going down the list. I was thinking, what years? And then I didn't even really think about the year 1965. I was like, oh, wait, Dr. Zhivago is in 1965. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about Dr. Zhivago for a podcast.
Sure, sure. Just kind of build the list around that. That's a common method of choosing the year, buddy. Don't sweat that.
Yeah, but you know, looking around, I was like, oh, yeah, there's, you know, some couple of my, like, films that are, like, were favorites with, that I enjoy with my dad are in this year and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, this is actually... This would be a fitting year. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, you put together a really intriguing list, and I'm anxious to walk through it with you. Before we do, Mike is going to walk us through some of the big doings in the world outside of the movie palaces in 1965. Here's headlines.
1965.
Mm-hmm.
America was doing big things.
We were, sort of.
Feeling pretty good about ourselves.
Oh, we were, yeah.
We were just really starting to act a fool in Vietnam. We were passing civil rights bills. You know, the protests seemed sort of localized. We were very proud of ourselves.
We were.
We had elected Lyndon Johnson. Yeah. In March, a bunch of people famously took a walk in Selma, Alabama. John Lewis and hundreds of other protesters felt the full impact of Southern hospitality. You have definitely seen the pictures. I'm not going to walk you through the details because they're fucking terrible. There's lots of documentaries about this hike and a fine film photographed by friend of the show, Bradford Young.
Yes, indeed.
Lots of good ways to find out about that pivotal event in American history. Heavyweight champ Muhammad Ali knocked out Sonny Liston in the first minute of the first round, and he didn't stop talking about that shit for like the next 50 years.
And bravo for him for that. I wouldn't have shut the fuck up about it either. Is this, I'm sorry, because I am usually good at IDing my Ali fights. This is like the famous photo of him standing over him, right? That's the Liston fight. Okay. Yeah. That's like an all-time great photo. Like, holy shit.
All-time great. And for the rest of his life, people asked Sonny Liston if he threw that fight, and he was like, you've obviously never been punched in the face by Muhammad Ali.
Amen.
In June, Ed White did the scariest thing humans have ever done when he became the first of us to do a spacewalk during the Gemini 4 mission. We do a lot of dumb shit, but like, he got in a little metal box, left the atmosphere of Earth, and then took the further mad step of leaving the little box to just float around in the vast expanse of open space. And there's a lot of scary shit in the world that I wouldn't do. That's got to be the...
That's pretty near the top.
Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
Apparently he had never seen... Well, gravity hadn't come out yet. He was attached to a little rope, so everything worked out, and he got home. Shout out to Ed White, the fucking absolute lunatic, if there ever was one.
Yes, indeed. Amen. Ed White.
Here's a news item that's been mostly memory hold. The U.S. occupied and held the Dominican Republic for most of 1965. Did you know that?
No.
It's the Dominican Civil War. This is another one of those terrible post-World War II stories where a country elects a leader who tries to roll back some of the colonial bullshit, you know, agreements made by his predecessors that were put there by the, right, blah, blah, you know. Mm-hmm. Then the CIA says, oh, well, you're a commie, and then the military takes it. We did this a lot.
We sure did. It was a growth industry in this era.
I'm not going to say it's the reason the world is fucked up right now, but it definitely is the way the world is fucked up right now.
Yeah,
is mostly sort of a rollout of this whole scenario. So that was going down in the Dominican Republic. We didn't really talk about it much then, and we don't talk about it now.
Well, we just did,
Winston Churchill died long after he should have, and Malcolm X was murdered long before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, that's not actually good English, is it? That's suggesting that Malcolm X should have been murdered, but just later? That wasn't what I meant.
Yeah, that's true.
That was bad English. Anyway, my point was made. Tokyo took over from New York as the world's largest city.
Very good.
In November, British theater critic Kenneth Tynan said fuck on BBC Three.
Tynan!
Many people who think about such things believe this is the first time anyone said the big bad of the English language on the premier English language network. He has several ex-wives who would like you to know that he was an abuser and a generally philandering, terrible person. But he was a great fucking critic. Do you know what his middle name was?
Tell me.
Peacock. Jason, I think you should change your middle name to Peacock.
I mean, I'm seriously contemplating it.
And finally, in December was the premiere of A Charlie Brown Christmas. The very first, and I think still most famous of the Peanuts specials, right?
Yep.
It's still more famous than the Halloween one, don't you think?
Yes, it's
I think it depends on a certain generation.
Fair enough.
There you go. Enough. I mean, it does have the original Charlie Brown theme, but it does not have the Great Pumpkin. So, you know, there's arguments to be made either way, I suppose.
Who among us have not made the I got a rock joke?
That's headlines.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Robert Daniels, ready to do a top five?
Yeah.
All right, so we're doing a non-ranked list, sort of just a vibes-based, let's flow and kind of move back and forth from pleasant to unpleasant subject matter. But we're starting Escapist. So what is the first film on your top five for 1965?
First film on my top five is Flight of the Phoenix.
This was the best-selling novel of man's pride and fury. And this is the motion picture, exulting in the vastness of human hope and human courage to scale new heights of adventure.
But I'm telling you this, if it happens again and I see who's doing it, I'll kill him.
Aldrich.
Yep.
So what is your background with this one? Why do you love this one so much?
You know, funny enough, this was one of my dad's favorite films.
It's a real dad movie.
It is a dad movie.
Yeah.
And I remember when the remake came out with Hugh Laurie and, yeah. and Dennis Quaid.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, this not knowing any better. I mean, I still kind of have a soft spot in my heart for the remake.
Sure.
I was like, oh, this remake's actually pretty nice. And my dad was like, wait, have you not seen the original? I'm like, no, I'm like 12. Like,
what? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm at the other end of some of those conversations now, so I'm feeling for both of you right now.
And so he was like, "Wait, how haven't you seen this?" So I mean, you're the parent, so
right.
So I think one day it was just on TCM, know, like all good things.
Of course,
it was just on TCM, and we watched it together, and I was like, "Oh, this is loads better than the remake." shout out to Hugh Laurie, though, who's actually really, really detestable in the remake.
Right, right.
He's the only one who gets the vibe, really gets the vibe
right.
of it.
Exactly. So, and what holds up for it in it for you? What do you like so much about this one?
I mean, the concept's just so good. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of survivalist films.
Sure.
I like also big ensemble disaster films, which just counts as
sure.
And yeah, I mean, those are like the two, I mean, like those are just kind of catnip for me,
sure.
in terms of just
well,
like,
and it's also, even though they don't make it anywhere, it's also got that kind of like mid 60s men on a mission, like, you know, Great Escape, Dirty Dozen sort of vibe to it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
No doubt because of Aldrich, you know, and him sort of bringing it to those. But yeah, you're right. It really is. It's a nice combination of all of those very venerable sort of story, points.
Yeah, yeah, especially like, you know, you think about the Great Escape, you know, think about the bringing together of the plan, you know, like the mechanics is kind of like one of those escape movies, also kind of like what you would see like in a heist film almost, mm-hmm. you know. So it's and I think it's just like a incredibly well shot film, and the Criterion edition that came out I think like last year
ago, yeah.
or something. Mariah E. Gates, my partner had not actually seen The Flight of the Phoenix, and so I was like, we have to watch this. And it was the first time I'd probably seen it in a decade, and I was just amazed by how well, like, how great the visual language is, and like what is kind of like a, I mean, what is very much an escapist popcorn film, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's just a tightly calibrated, tightly constructed film that and one last thing, but the monkey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Hanging on at the end.
Yeah.
The monkey.
Come on, monkey.
Which tells you how great of a director Aldrich is that like he actually had like a nice punch in for the monkey. Like the monkey gets its own close up.
Yeah. Yeah.
He knew we needed to know what the status of the monkey was.
Yeah.
And
we sure did.
He knew that we needed that.
Well, you know, and he's a prescient artist, you know, he knew that, you know, about 12, 13 years later, there'd be a big movement of monkey movies. He's just trying to get in ahead of the curve. Talk to me about Jimmy Stewart in this movie.
Yeah. So Jimmy Stewart, it's funny. We were kind of like joking beforehand, like, let's be on like a bright kind of note. And then I thought about it for a second. I was like, wait, this is like post-war Jimmy Stewart cycling through possible PTSD. Like, this is the light note of the podcast, just to give listeners a preview of of the tone that this is going to hit soon. But yeah, no, I think Jimmy Stewart, I mean, of course, you know, he had been kind of cycling through these kind of like darker films with Anthony Mann. You know, you get stuff like Winchester 73 and The Naked Spur and stuff like that. And just, I mean, I think some of like Jimmy Stewart's best work. I think he's like one of those like classic film stars who's like the second half of his career might have been better than the first half. And the first half of his career was really fucking pretty good.
Yeah. No, he's the way that he's complicating his persona in those post-war films is really fascinating and really, and yeah, and sort of, you know, clouds the very simple-minded common wisdom about what that persona was that has sort of persisted to this day. Like, people think about, you know, the end of It's a Wonderful Life and not like the move into the third act of It's a Wonderful Life. You know, like, he was capable of bringing some really dark moments to the screen and some real shadings to those characterizations. I think.
Yeah. Oh, and he yells at his kids and It's a Wonderful Life. You're like, oh, shit. Fuck George Bailey.
I thought this was a warm-hearted family film. He's straight yelling at those children.
Okay, right. I know we have acknowledged that this is a dad film, but I just have to say that my father started his career hand-building airplanes for Boeing, and then he became an aircraft engineer where he was designing parts and you know, being a part of the like intellectual part of building planes. And then right before he retired, he started flying RC planes. So this is a my dad movie. As much as if this is an anybody dad movie, this is a my dad movie. And I had never seen this before. This was a first time watch for me. So then I had to ask him next time I saw him if he had seen the movie. And he goes, he didn't even say whether or not he had seen the movie. His response was, I think it would have worked. Oh shit, all right. And then his next question was, have you seen the remake? It's pretty good too.
All right. So. Dad, bring it in. Thank you, Mike's dad. Thank you, Steve. Robert Daniels, what is the next movie on your top five for 1965?
The next film. Slender Thread.
A tenuous slender thread that binds a woman to a strange, strong man on one dramatic night in their lives that neither will ever forget. The slender thread, breaking strand by strand when a woman seeks a new road, a new comfort, a new understanding.
I just want somebody to talk to.
Maybe I can suggest somebody for you to see.
No, you don't understand. I need somebody now.
Which is a film that I had only recently seen. It was programmed at the 2021 TCM Film Festival.
Oh, okay.
The intro was done by the late, great Sergio Mims, great Chicago critic, co-founder of Shadow and Act and the Black Harvest Film Festival in Chicago. But Sidney Pollack's directorial debut. Sidney Poitier is in it with Anne Bancroft opposite him. And it's just kind of like a refreshingly frank conversation about suicidal ideations, you know? Really well constructed film that has like a conceit that could get old quickly, you know? Sidney Poitier is playing a college student who one night is manning a crisis helpline, and Anne Bancroft plays a wife and mother who has one night decided to swallow a lot of pills, and she's just looking for someone to keep her company until she drifts off into the good night. Sidney Poitier, of course, spends the entire time trying to trace her location in order to save her. It's a smaller cast as compared to Flight of the Phoenix, but some really good ones, like Ed Asner as a random cop who just doesn't want to be home.
Yeah.
Telly Savalas also as the head of the crisis center. Stephen Hill is a absolutely wretched husband.
yeah, he's just some bad behavior there. This one was one that I had meant to see and hadn't seen, so this was one of my first time watches for this one, which I appreciate. What was crazy about it was when I went to pull the trailers, you know, for audio for the show, what a cornerstone of the ad campaign they were doing out of, you know, Sidney Poitier and Anne Bancroft together at last. And it's like, they actually share no scenes. They're never on screen together. They're always on opposite ends of these phone calls. Now, what I think is great about the movie and about their work in it is they do feel like they're in the whole movie together, even though they're in these separate locations, even though they're over these phone lines, that the sort of the intimacy that they create in those conversations makes it feel like real in that way. If they hadn't been able to achieve that, the movie doesn't work at all, which is a real risk for a director to take, I think.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, the only kind of, I guess, stand-in we get for Bancroft is whenever Pollock cuts to the speaker at the crisis helpline, which is kind of like a dopey cut. Mm. You know?
Sure.
But it works because these two actors, because he waits a little while before he makes that. You know, he lets that connection kind of form between these two actors before he does that cut. And then that cut kind of becomes like the stand-in that I think works really, really well throughout. And of course, you know, there is the flashbacks of like how did Anne Bancroft get in this situation that helps us kind of along the way, right? And but there's some also just some like wonderful seamless cuts in and out of the flashbacks, some wonderful like sound cuts that are just kind of like whenever Sidney Poitier is yelling and exasperated, which is probably like some of the most anger Sidney Poitier has ever shown on screen is in this movie. Like, there's more scenes of him shouting than like in The Heat of the Night, you know?
Yeah.
And he gets slapped in that movie.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's a bit more heightened a situation. I will say, you know, I went back and sort of looked up Pollock's career chronology because I just so think of him as a guy who started in the 70s. And so I was a little surprised. I was like, oh, this is a Sidney Pollock movie, even though it's 65. As you mentioned, his feature directorial debut, he had moved over from television. He started out in that same sort of golden age, directing episodes of like The Fugitive and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. And then made the move to two features, a very similar trajectory to the next director that we're going to talk about. And then, of course, the other commonality between them, and I know you can appreciate this. I glanced away during his title card, but I knew this was a Quincy Jones score. Like, it is such a mid-60s, in the best possible way, the most complimentary way, such a Quincy Jones score. The music in this is just, like, impeccable. And he also did the music for the next movie on your top five. So, Robert Daniels, what is movie number three?
Pawnbroker by Sidney Lumet.
Yeah.
What makes you so bitter?
Bitter? I'm a man of no anger. I have no desire for vengeance for what was done to me. I have escaped from the emotions. I am safe within myself. All I ask and want is peace and quiet.
Why haven't you found?
Because people like you will not let me.
You know, that little indie director. That. But, I mean, yeah, Pawnbroker is another film that is mostly takes place in one location, you know, for the most part. And it is very flashback heavy as well.
Oh, God. The artistry of the flashbacks is
so
just
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So amazing. Yeah, you could definitely see like shades of like something like Hiroshima Monomore in this. You know, Pawnbroker, starring Rod Steiger as a survivor of the concentration camps during World War II, now living in New York as in a pawn shop. And he's like a sort of miserly fellow. You know, people come in with their objects that are clearly worth more than what he's willing to give them. Like, he literally is the originator of "best I can do is $2" meme. And he starts to kind of have this awakening of, you know, the business who he's basically been in business with. And of course, there's a lot of PTSD in this film. It's back to back films where it's like, really, I think, because again, the first half of the decade, I think you start getting less fuzzy, warm, kind of post-war nuclear family kind of stuff. And really, you start getting the kind of like, okay, so what were actually like the fragments that were left behind by the war? And also, what are like the like societal kind of like, you know, quote unquote ills or issues that we're facing? Think about like Days of Wine and Roses, which is a 1962 film, but like, you know, was one of the first films that really talked about alcoholism, right? And then, of course, in this, like, there's, like, clear allusions to drug taking. There's clear allusions, not even just allusions, like, there's prostitution and everything like that. So you get some of the more illicit kind of, like, components of life.
Yeah, yeah. And, those elements, and also just that, like, the explicit graphic nudity prompted this movie to get the C for Condemned rating from the Catholic Legion of Decency, which, of course, made it way more of a must-see movie for like so many people, you know, like suddenly it was something they had to go out and see. And it, I believe, was quite the financial success. Tremendously influential picture, especially in terms of The Cutting, which we mentioned. And Lumet, in his wonderful book, Making Movies, which I feel like we reference almost every episode of this show, he talks specifically about working up the sort of the subliminal cutting pattern, the methodology of that, the sort of math that they were doing on those. And then he culminates that section with like an apology to the reader. It's like, I'm sorry that this dominated advertising and movie making for so many years after we made The Pawnbroker. It was not my intention to do that. But it's really powerful. And the way that it comes together in that subway car sequence is sort of devastating, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely a few devastating sequences. Whenever, I mean, like the like track across like the barbed wire where you see the arms and everything like that, or when I'm blanking out. Thelma Oliver comes in and is trying to kind of make this deal for her boyfriend, so she offers up her body, and he gets like flashbacks to, you know, the rape that happened during World War II and stuff like that. And it's really just harrowing and shocking stuff, to the point of like, you're like, how did he get away with this? Yeah. Like, how was he doing this in 1965? Yeah. But yeah, and oh, actually not even 1965, because this is technically, I kind of cheated a little
bit.
Okay.
It's fine.
It's a 1964 film, but it did not come out in the U.S. until 1965.
We bleed red, white, and blue, Robert Daniels. The U.S. release date is the only one that matters.
Yeah, he had this and Failsafe technically in the same year, which is like insane. Like, how is this man doing this?
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, but why was everybody so mean to Saul Naserman? Like, I know he's like cranky, but it seemed like everybody was a real fucking dick to this guy. Is there something in the beginning that like some piece of dialogue I missed or something?
No,
like,
he was just, you know.
Because I'm just sort of watching the movie like, you guys fucking deserve his attitude. I mean, the miserly prices. All right, okay. But that's, you know, that's obviously like, that works in Pawn Stories.
Par for the course.
To this day, there's plenty of examples, right? But I don't know. I felt like the neighborhood was a little hard on Saul.
You have an old lady coming in and trying to pawn his stuff. He's like, best I can do is $2. I'd be like, look at that fucking dick.
He's probably not generous in the corner store, right?
There you go.
Oh, and one other thing I want to mention with this film is the incredible Brock Peters, who's in a totally different role than he was in To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. You know, which the Kill a Mockingbird, you know, the very like stoic kind of like, you know, dignified black man, you know, and this is like,
it's got some electricity to him in this.
Yeah, thing. Yeah, there's like, it's like before Pulse Soul Cool was a thing, mm-hmm. like he had it. Mm-hmm. it's like contemporary soul cool, you know. And yeah, so it's definitely it's this, and his performance almost kind of reminded me, I'm blanking on the lead actor now, but in Melvin Van Peebles' Story of a 3-Day Pass.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah, they kind of have, I feel like, this almost like the same vibe to them. But in any case, yeah.
Yeah, that totally scans. All right. So what then, Robert, is the fourth film on your 1965 top five?
Fourth film is Chimes at Midnight.
By the great Orson Welles, a.k.a. Falstaff.
Yes.
Originally released, I believe, in the U.S. as Falstaff, but I could have that backwards.
Where is the Prince of Wales?
We do not know, my lord.
Inquire at London, amongst the taverns. For there they say he daily doth frequent, with unrestrained loose companions.
Poor bastard, son of the king.
That villainous, abominable misleader of youth!
It's my second... I think, well, no, I'm sorry, man, this is, nah, I just put myself in a corner. By trying to do Orson Welles ranking
on the spot, Orson Welles ranking.
it's my third favorite. No, it's my third favorite because I think Magnificent Ambersons is up there, and Citizen Kane was my one and two. Chimes of Midnight, number three. But I do think Chimes of Midnight, I think, is his second most visually accomplished film.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the compositions in this are just...
It's astonishing.
It's incredible. I mean, it's, like, it's hard to kind of, like, top the craziness of, like, Citizen Kane and what he's doing visually with his visual language and what is the oral language in that film. But this one comes really close.
It sure does. It really does. And also with, like, significantly fewer resources at his disposal to create this one than he did in those days. Like, this was one of his famously sort of, you know, made piecemeal over several months and several continents and financed by his, you know, sellout acting gigs and all of that sort of stuff. And yet that it's got such a consistent and consistently striking visual language is really, really incredible. A Shakespeare movie, one of his three, but the sort of the most inventively adapted of those films, because he's basically taking, he's making a mixtape, basically. He's making a Shakespeare mixtape. He's taken scenes from three or four different plays that involve this relationship, you know, between Prince Hal and Falstaff, and really piecing them together in a very clever way.
Yeah, it's like, kind of, like, only Orson Welles would have the confidence to do this. Because, like,
we talked a couple weeks ago about Soderbergh having the Stones to recut 2001, and I think this is about on that level.
Yeah, like, nobody, if you, like, went today and said, oh yeah, I'm gonna do, like, a combination of, like, four or five different, you know, because it's like Merry Wives of Windsor, it's like Henry V, Henry IV, and I think Richard II in this. Like, about four different Shakespeare plays. Yeah. Like, people would literally burn down your house.
Yeah.
Like, literally burn down your house. And Orson was like, I'll do it. I'll do it, like, on a skin flint budget.
Well, and he had done it on stage. Like, this had started out as a stage production that did all of that and then sort of brilliantly adapted it. What do you think it is about his Shakespeare movies that makes them so audience friendly? Like, I really feel like there are a few filmmakers that where even if you're sort of not well versed in the specifics of Shakespearean language, it's very easy to not only follow but be thoroughly engaged and entertained by these movies. What do you think he did that was so, that made that work so much?
That's a good question. You know what? I think he understands the language, which is always, like, that's the cop-out of, like, why doesn't this work?
Yeah,
this work and why doesn't this work? It's always because they understand the language and they understand the intent of the language, right? And I also think that he isn't as... I mean, there is, of course, he is conscious of meter. Mm-hmm. Not as conscious, I think, as other directors. Like Kenneth Branagh is like, the meter is like strict, you know?
That makes sense. Yeah.
Whereas like with this, like there's a clear kind of like rhythm and a bounce, you know, to it. And in some ways it kind of reminds me of what Denzel did with Macbeth, with Tragedy of Macbeth, because I think what Denzel's great at is marrying his star persona with the language, right? And so there are moments where he says it in that Shakespearean kind of meter, and there are moments where he says it in the Denzel meter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Orson Welles is very good about making his meter and Shakespeare's meter kind of blend seamlessly, and so that it feels more approachable. It doesn't feel like you're kind of sitting and watching a stuffy kind of stage thing. Not that Shakespeare is stuffy, but
it can be staged that way.
Yeah, it can be staged that way. It can be staged if you have a little bit too much reverence for the text. And of course, Orson Welles has a lot of reverence for the text, but also Orson Welles is very smart.
Yeah, yeah. And understands the camera in a way that the directors who are putting Shakespeare on screen don't always. Yeah. Oh, God, this one holds up so well. All right. That brings us to the top. I don't know if it's the top of the heap. Maybe it's certainly the one that you built the list around. Robert, what is the fifth and final movie in your top five?
Now, I will preface this by saying I built this list around this, but this is not my favorite David Lean film.
That would be...
My favorite David Lean film is Bridge on the River Kwai.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
It's Bridge on River Kwai with Hobson's Choice.
Okay.
Very close second.
Wow. All right.
That's a
hell of a filmography if the top two doesn't include Lawrence. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, Lawrence is three for me. This is four.
Wow.
But that shows, the GOAT, David Lean. This is four, and Brief Encounters, five, and Passionate Friends is six.
he put a filmography together, didn't he?
Jesus Christ, it was amazing. But Dr. Zhivago, funny enough, has been kind of it's that movie when we are talking about Dr. Zhivago, by the way.
David Lean makes a magnificent film of Dr. Zhivago, says Life magazine. Dr. Zhivago, acclaimed everywhere as the most excitingly romantic film of the year. Dr. Zhivago, winner of 10 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture of the Year.
It is that movie that, the last two times I've seen it on the big screen, I'm like, maybe this is my favorite David Lean. He's kind of like the Beatles in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's what's your favorite Beatles song? It's the one I'm listening to right now.
Right.
Yeah. he's kind of like that where you just kind of see one of his films on a 70mm print in a sold out theater. And it's this is the peak of cinema. Why did we even make another movie after this?
It's like going to church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hilarious because David Lean took this project because he had done the big Bridge on the River Kwai. He had done Lawrence of Arabia, right? And so he wanted something more intimate, air quotes.
He wanted to make a little movie, a small indie, if you will.
He was like, yeah, he hadn't made a romance in a while,
sure.
And of course, sure. David Lean, king of romances.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
And so, but of course, David Lean is kind of if you're going to give me the budget, I might as well make a 3-hour romance. surprising that this film, of course, doesn't have Peter O'Toole. He'd originally offered the role to Peter O'Toole. Mm-hmm. Peter O'Toole turned it down.
Okay.
We got quote unquote downgraded with Omar Sharif.
We came out all right in that.
One of the most handsome men in film history.
Yeah.
Sophia Loren was actually supposed to be Laura. Actually, it was originally acquired with David Lean to direct with because the producer Sophia Loren's husband and it acquired it to be a star vehicle for for her. And David Lean was like, I've got Julie Christie right.
Yeah. Yeah. Love to Loren, but that's not quite the right casting for that. Or maybe it's just impossible to imagine anybody else in the role. I don't know.
Funny enough, okay, so this is something I was kind of rereading, because I've got a few David Lean books, and this has been it's in a couple of David Lean books, but it's also been reprinted on Wikipedia if you don't want to read through two or three volumes of David Lean stuff. But the reason that apparently he didn't want Sophia Loren was because he didn't believe that Sophia Loren could believably play a virgin.
I mean,
it's hard to argue with the man's instinct on that.
Because of her prior filmography, he was like, there's no way the audience is going to believe that she is a virgin. We need, like, a blonde hair.
Wow.
We need someone who's, like, the purest of the pure. Let's get Julie Christie in here. Is essentially how it went. But, like, Sylvia said in this, it's like another flashback. Have you actually the entire film is a flashback.
Yeah.
Of Alec Guinness, who plays a Soviet soldier who is looking for the for his niece, who is the daughter of Omar Sharif and Julie Christie, Yuri and Lara. And Omar Sharif plays a poet who wrote a volume of poems dedicated to Lara. And so we flash back to the Russian Revolution, and we go from there through this tumultuous love affair between these two people that is being divided by politics and rape and just all the bad things in life and including Tom Courtney, who is actually the only of the 10 Oscar nominations. You know, there was only one for acting, and it's Tom Courtney's.
Wow,
which is kind of wild.
That is wild. It's nutty. Yeah, no, I do love too that this is also in this period where like any Hollywood epic that took place in a country that wasn't America, it was like, okay, well, you all just speak with British accents. Like that was the go-to, like it's in another place because they all have British accents.
I can imagine an American audience who's like, oh, this is so exotic.
Yes. Exactly. Well, I've said on the show a million times that the greatest thing about doing it is to get recommendations from smart people and then to have an excuse to watch the movie that you've never gotten around to seeing. And this was my first time watching Dr. Zhivago. Was for the show. I know. Like I got to turn in my, you know, my cinephile card.
I mean, you know, it is 3 hours.
It's you have to clear some space. You got to clear a part of the day. But it is like it's that thing that he did so well. It's that epic scope, but it never feels impersonal in its telling. It's the ability to simultaneously tell a story on a giant canvas with such incredible intimacy is something that he and not many other filmmakers, I think, have had, period.
Yeah, I can't think of any. I mean, I can't think of many people. I mean, I think like even though people call his films cold, I don't feel the coldness, but Nolan is like someone who I think of is able to do that big scale with intimacy, particularly something like Oppenheimer, which is like, I think the furthest thing from cold, but.
Right. Well, yeah. And you know, and Spielberg does it.
Yeah. Spielberg does it a lot.
And when that's the company we're talking about, like that's saying something. Mike, what were you going to say?
When you and I were like starting to, you know, pay attention to the world and form our own opinions, there was a lot of sort of concentration on authenticity, and this era was just not considered. It was just sort of,
right,
this wasn't it. This wasn't the time. And so if we're going to go and delve into things, you know, we didn't delve into 1965 because it was sort of a fake, you know, big studio, blah, blah, bullshit kind of. And so we start, so we sort of do 70s and actually earlier.
Right.
And actually much earlier, you know, when the sort of technology and the money and everything, and everybody wasn't so beautiful, everything wasn't so sort of organized and together. And we kind of had to work our way like back from two directions.
Yeah.
Into, we've had some of these conversations about 50s movies and stuff too, where it's like, you've seen fucking Hitchcock.
Right.
But like, and I think that there is sort of, it's taken at least me a while to sort of find a different, you know, to find the things about this that were special and interesting and valuable, even though, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is not strictly necessarily true.
Right.
though, you know, maybe some of these people have some weird act, even though there's all of these sort of obvious things that are easy to just say, well, this is all bullshit because of thus and so, right? Representative things that were a part of the industry at that time.
Yeah.
But to sort of learn how to see through that to a deeper truth.
Yeah.
And to sort of understand, like, well, no, like, if this guy worked on this movie, look at all the other shit he made. Like, there's right. something, there's a reason why he made this. There's something that he wanted, you know, that he wanted us to sort of get from this. And to learn to see past the sort of, you know, the poster's very cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fucking 7-minute overture. Like, right, oh, right. Lord have mercy, I'm already checked out. You know, which is, I think, a sort of attitude that at least I was bringing to a lot of these kind of movies for a long time. You know, and I'm glad to have gotten rid of it.
Yeah. I mean, as with most, you know, as with just about anything outside of the current moment, you just have to learn how to watch movies in each period. You have to sort of relearn how to watch them and what your expectations are and that sort of thing. Yeah, we haven't done a lot in the mid-60s, but I mean, these are all really great movies. This was a really, like, exemplary top five, and so I appreciate you bringing it to us, Robert.
Nothing but bangers, honestly. yeah, and by, like, I think, you know, directors who are either at the top of their game or directors who are going to become great filmmakers, you know, if they aren't already. And yeah, you know, 65 is kind of like, you know, especially like the late 60s. I mean, it's the training ground for before you get to like the 70s. So of course, you get the new school, but of course you also have like a lot of great technicians who were still working in the 70s who, you know, really, really got their bona fides started there.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's find out a little bit about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 1965. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute.
Hollywood freaks on the Hollywood scene.
Robert's beloved Dr. Zhivago did quite well at the box office in 65, coming in second only to another big, long, expensive Hollywood epic, The Sound of Music, which displaced Gone with the Wind as the highest-grossing movie ever made and saved 20th Century Fox from the brink of bankruptcy, where it had been teetering since the fiasco of Cleopatra 2 years earlier.
Robert, how do you feel about the old Sound of Music?
I hate the Sound of Music. I hate the Sound of Music. It's like one of the two musicals I hate the most. It's that and West Side Story. So I was not too happy when West Side Story was remade by Spielberg. Also, like, wasn't the Sound of Music, it wasn't just like made a crap load of money, but wasn't like number one or something for like 40 weeks out of that year?
Yeah, it was like insane.
Some insane run.
It was, it did really well. Mike, how did it do with the Oscars?
Sound of Music also did quite well at the Oscars, picking up prizes for Best Picture, Best Director Robert Wise. Other winners that year included Lee Marvin, Best Actor for Cat Ballou.
Hell yes.
Julie Christie, Best Actress, not for Dr. Zhivago, but for Darling, talk about a year. That nice virgin-appearing lady. Best Supporting Actor Martin Balsam for 1,000 Clowns, and Best Supporting Actress Shelley Winter for A Patch of Blue. One of Sidney Poitier's other two 1965 releases. Couldn't escape that guy.
Yep. Robert, any thoughts on any of those pictures?
Let's see. I'm thinking right now. Let's run through them again.
Patch of Blue, 1,000 Clowns, Darling, Cat Ballou.
Lee Marvin winning for Cat Ballou is wild.
That's not. I think it's wild in a great way. That is an inspired comic performance. You cannot point to a lot of great comic performances getting, especially the lead actor Oscar.
Yeah, the lead's hard. I mean, we've seen him like supporting, like, yeah, you know, like Jack Palance and
Marissa Tomei.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like there's some, but like, best support. Who was he up against that year? I think it's like a stacked year.
I think it's one of those times where we shouldn't look.
I think stacked year.
I think we're gonna be like,
you're like, wait, Cat Ballou?
I think we're gonna say good for him and not know.
Nat King Cole, like the most wooden actor in the history of Hollywood. I love Nat King Cole's music, but the man couldn't act. I'm sorry, St. Louis Blues is not a good film. Patch of Blue, great though.
Zhivago won 5 Oscars, all in below the line categories. Some people were mad about that, but the drama, comedy, or musical split of the Golden Globes meant that it actually did much better at the Globes, where it won Best Picture and Best Actor.
Okay.
Other noteworthy award winners that year included Richard Lester's The Knack and How to Get It, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville, which won the Golden Bear at Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Alphaville. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most tragic film industry story of the year? Are we going to call it of the year or of the history of movies?
It's not a great one.
The August 10th vault fire at MGM Studios, which wiped out the last copies of hundreds of now lost silent movies, including Todd Browning's London After Midnight and The Divine Woman starring Greta Garbo. An honest to God tragedy. Yeah.
Mariah E. Gates would definitely call it the worst day in maybe the history of art.
She Mariah sure would.
E. Gates, noted silent film historian.
Yes, indeed. Join us later in the season to talk with her about 1924.
She was, I'm just going to warn you, Jason. She was big mad that she couldn't do some of the teens. Mariah's the kind of person, she loves going to Porto Nonnes silent film festival in northern Italy where they play silent soap commercials.
We'll hear all about it.
Stan Laurel left us in 1965, as did singer and actor Nat King Cole, super producer David O. Selznick, Oscar-winning actress Judy Holliday, sex symbols Dorothy Dandridge and Clara Bow, The Searcher screenwriter Frank S. Nugent, the Marx Brothers' great straight lady Margaret DeMont,
R.I.P.,
and production code administrator Joseph Breen, the guy who actually started enforcing the Hays Code in 1934, so fuck him.
Amen.
But we also welcomed into the world Chris Rock, Brandon Lee, Diane Lane, Maura Tierney, Michael Bay, Dr. Dre, Robert Downey Jr., Sarah Jessica Parker, Martin Lawrence, Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan, Frank Grillo, Brooke Shields, Tracy Letts, John C. fucking Riley, Ileana Douglas, Doug Liman, Kadeem Hardison, Sam Mendes, Viola Davis, Marley Matlin, Maria de Mier... Oh, so many names. Maria de Medeiros.
Maria de Medeiros.
But there's an extra.
Just ignore those. Maria de Medeiros. Trust me, I watched the Pulp Fiction trailer like 40 times. It's Maria de Medeiros.
Maria de Medeiros. The late Chris Penn, Mads Mikkelsen, Ben Stiller, Oscar nominee Jeffrey Wright, and Alex Winter, who is not only an accomplished actor and filmmaker, but the very first guest of this here podcast. And that's your Hollywood Minute.
Thank you, Mike.
Can I just say really quickly, I was at Black Harvest Film Festival in Chicago, and they were doing a John Singleton tribute. And so before every John Singleton film, before every film, they played a trailer from a John Singleton film. And they played his remake of Shaft. Mm-hmm. And I had totally forgotten Jeffrey Wright's accent in Shaft.
Yeah.
It's wonderful and brilliant and horrifying all at the same time.
Yes, it sure is.
That is Oscar nominee now, Jeffrey. That's right. So I will put some respect to his name.
Yes, indeed. All right, Robert, you ready to do a lightning round?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, you know how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. And here we go. James Bond in Thunderball.
Oh, fuck me, no.
Blake Edwards, The Great Race.
We're going through some drags. So Thunderball made a lot of money too,
sure
though.
Did.
It like
sure
was
did.
Like the other film that was like number one. I think it was like every week of 1965, I want to say, was like, it was either a James Bond film or The Sound of Music that was number one, except for like 2 weeks out of the year.
Yeah. 65 also saw the release of Disney's That Darn Cat.
Oh, actually, I have a soft spot in my heart for That Darn Cat.
There we go. Otto Preminger had two pictures out in 65, In Harm's Way and Bunny Lake is Missing.
Oh, I've not seen Buddy Lake.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah, I've not seen that one.
I just caught up with it very recently. It's really good. We had two Godard films, the aforementioned Alphaville and also Pierrot Le Fou.
Mm. Well, Alphaville. Funny enough, I'm just coming from Berlin Film Festival, and the persistent theme throughout Berlin was like movies that had weird voices in them. And I couldn't help but think about Alphaville the whole time I was watching.
Yep. The recently departed Norman Jewison's The Cincinnati Kid came out in 1965.
Oh, I like that one. That's a Bond runner. Yeah.
little early Woody Allen picture called What's New Pussycat.
Oh, yeah. I've not seen that one.
It's not great. It's very much, if you want to see like the most 1965 movie imaginable, check out What's New Pussycat. Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah. That's all you need to say about that one. Sam Peckinpah's Major Dundee.
Oh yeah, now I'm trying to remember if I've seen, because I remember looking at this list of 65 movies, and I was trying to remember if I'd seen Major Dundee, or if it'd been like, if it was one of those things that like I saw when I was a kid, because it was like on TCM. I feel like I saw it when I was a kid when it was on TCM, but I haven't like returned to it.
It's pretty. I saw it for the first time fairly recently when a new Blu-ray came out, and it's a good one. It's a good one. Future collaborators Arthur Penn and Warren Beatty got together on a picture called Mickey One.
Not see that one.
Fair enough. Sergio Leone's For a Few Dollars More.
I fucking love For a Few Dollars More. I actually think it might be better than A Fistful of Dollars.
I think it is. I really think it is. Yeah, it's a fucking banger. Richard Lester reteamed with the Beatles for a little bit of magic called Help.
Oh yeah, Help. I love Help. Like, I mean, A Hard Day's Night is like probably like the best music film of all time. Mm-hmm. Help is pretty good.
Help is pretty good. Yeah. Shout out to the frequently mentioned Uncle Dave, the only person on the planet I know who actually prefers Help to A Hard Day's Night.
Wow.
You know what?
I wish I could live my life by that ethos.
he's been sending out hot takes since I was 10 years old, buddy. Another Sidney Lumet movie in 1965, Sean Connery in The Hill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was making the list. I was like, Sidney Lumet was killing it that year.
Yeah, busy dude. Busy dude. The Hill is pretty fucking good. It's no Parm Barker. Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits.
Oh, I fucking love that one. Yeah. No, I mean, I just load Fellini into my veins. I mean, of course, my favorite is a basic. It's 8.5 is my favorite.
Well, but, you know, I mean, but, come on.
You know, Amacord is up there. Of course.
Yeah.
That's a Kiberian, yeah.
Peter O'Toole as Lord Jim.
That's one of the... So Mariah's a massive fan of Peter O'Toole. Like, massive. And that's one of the few Peter O'Tooles I have not seen. My favorite Peter O'Toole is Venus. That's actually my favorite one.
Nice. Michael Caine in the Ipcress file.
Ooh, not seen that one.
Akira Kurosawa's Redbeard.
Oh, hell yeah.
Roman Polanski's Repulsion.
Oh yeah. And funny enough, I hadn't seen that until recently. It was when Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho came
out. Gotcha.
Yeah, because of course he's pulling from that a lot. Yeah.
The Greatest Story Ever Told.
This is one I'm like. I was like, have I seen this? Or has this just been like omnipresent on my TV like every like Easter?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, have I actually sat down and actually watched it front to back?
Right. Hard to know. It's a familiar story. Perhaps my favorite title of 1965, Doris Wishman's Bad Girls Go to Hell.
Oh, you know what? We've got like a whole Doris Wishman set that Vinegar Syndrome put out.
Yes.
And we haven't cracked into it yet. So
that's the entry point is Bad Girls Go to Hell, in my humble opinion. And finally, the Laurence Olivier directed by and starring Othello.
Okay, so I'm going to say this. Part of me wanted to choose for this podcast to have this in Chimes at Midnight.
Yeah.
Back to back. So we could get into the Orson Welles doing a black cast Shakespeare. But and so I could just say, fuck Laurence Olivier for doing this. Like, probably like the most, like, of course, of the period. And he was on like kind of the back end of like, this was kind of like the last year you could get away with it a little
blackface, with literal blackface.
But it's definitely one of the like most like violently racist images next to like the like Mickey Rooney as a Chinese man or anything in Birth of a Nation.
There we go. That's your trifecta from hell. All right, Robert Daniels, excellent work on the lightning round. Where can people follow you and read your work?
Yeah, so you can follow me on social on the artist formerly known as Twitter X at 812 Film Reviews, also on Letterboxd at 812 Film Reviews. And you can maybe do it on IG. That's not a guarantee I'm going to say yes.
That's fair. That's
just don't friend me on Facebook because that happens quite a bit. I might have never met this person. I don't know who this person is. Please leave me alone. And then for the writing, I mean, the writing will occur on those other places. But the writing, associate editor RodTrooper.com. So a lot of my work shows up there. And then New York Times is probably the next one. And then for the purposes of this festival, I believe just about everything I'm writing for this festival will be for Screen International. So yeah, all those lovely, lovely places.
That they're kind enough to pay us for our words. I'm Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show, including this one. Mike, where can people find you?
I am at BrainwashLib on Twitter and at Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like this show and think other people might like it too, the greatest favor you can do us is leaving us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. There is just an astronomical number of Dudes Talking About Movies podcasts out there, so your recommendations really do help bring us to the top of that heap. Mike, before we go, what is your favorite film of 1965?
Well, look, this is the year Bloody Pit of Horror came out, but I can't. I'm gonna go with Spy Who Came In From the Cold. I think that if I had seen that movie before I had read any of Le Carre's books, I might not have liked it because it seems like there's sort of not a lot happening, and then all of a sudden it's just at the end and so on and so forth. But when you've read the books, and you know, there's been a lot of movies. He made a lot of books. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of movies made of his books, you know. But this one, the Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the novel came out in 63, and then the movie comes out in 65. Yeah. So it feels very much like sort of, you know, I don't know. For some reason, it's just sort of, I've found it very fascinating to see this movie sort of set at that time and with all the sort of conventions of the time. Mm-hmm. Because now, you know, a lot of his books, these are not fucking Bourne novels.
Right.
You know, like, they're a lot about waiting around and shit not happening and people not knowing what they're doing. And, you know, but in a way they've sort of become in the same way that, like, you know, Philip Marlowe movies are almost their own sort of subgenre, you know, the Le Carre movies are sort of the same, but people always have this sort of, they always want to have some fast shit happen. You know, there's always at least a scene every now and then where something quick happens and we have an excuse to sort of turn up the music and turn up the editing.
Yeah.
And they resist that in the 65 Spy Who Came In From the Cold. It remains, I think, in a lot of ways, sort of closer to the experience of the novel than most of the other movie versions of his work. So
yeah.
I don't know. I like it a lot. I'm a big fan of that particular movie. And for some reason, like, it feels like the first, you know, hour and a half takes like 3 hours, and then the last 30 minutes takes like 90 seconds. I don't know exactly how it works, but it's not really like clear what's happening. There's not like some sort of hinge moment where everything gets exciting.
Yeah.
You know, it just, and it's like that with his books too, where just nothing makes sense until all of a sudden everything makes sense, and you're like, fuck me, this guy's a genius. That's another thing that I think they sort of pulled off that element of his novels in the 65 version in a way that very few other people have sort of pulled off. So Spy Who Came In From the Cold. How about you, buddy?
You know, the actual answer is Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, but I can't summarize it any more succinctly than Robert did in the lightning round. So I'm going to go with a kind of an obscure one, a New York exploitation picture called Who Killed Teddy Bear, from director Joseph Cates. This stars a, you know, post-accident, decline of his career, Salminio, in a very sketchy character role. Elaine Stritch pops up in support, and I'm like, I'm in for anything Elaine wow. Stritch is in. But it's a really kind of grimy, grubby, you know, sort of 42nd Street, red light district, killer, skeezy, shades of sort of like a lot of stuff that ends up happening in Taxi Driver. You know, there's a lot of like, you know, porno bookshops in it and stuff. It's really a peek at that world, really before much of anyone else was making movies there. So it's a great piece of anthropology, but it's also just a great sort of weird, semi-campy, you know, cult movie, thriller, sort of neo-noir-y. I don't know. It's hard to describe except to say that, you know, it's Who Killed Teddy Bear with Sal Mineo and Elaine Stritch. So track it down and you'll enjoy it. Thank you again, Robert.
I just added that to my watch list.
Yay!
On Letterboxd. So, very rare to find a movie that neither Mariah or I have not seen.
Glad. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very...